Today, with our biography that we're going to look at, we're going to travel firstly to the wonderful Emerald Isle of Ireland. This is where Amy Carmichael was born in 1867, into a wonderful, godly Christian home. Now, discipline in this home was extraordinarily severe by our modern standards, but later Amy would always say that there was not a happier child than she was. She was the eldest of seven children, and they lived in this beautiful coastal town of Mill Isle, with its green fields, its wild weather, and the raging North Sea. They were a relatively prosperous family. Her father was a mill owner, so they had things like governesses and maids and servants and things growing up. And Amy was a fairly lively child and perhaps needed the very strict discipline. There's one particular account of her childhood when she was told by her mother not to eat the seeds of the laburnum tree in their neighbourhood. They were poisonous. Well, that led her to do a little experiment. She thought she would lead her younger siblings to see how many seeds they could eat before they died. Well, luckily, they were found out, and the experiment didn't reach its final conclusion. Well, Amy loved nature, and she loved animals. And one day she found a mouse that had fallen into a pail of water, and she rescued it. But just at that moment, her father called for family prayers. And so she stuffed the mouse in her pocket, and she went into the living room and sat there, hoping that the mouse would just stay in her pocket. Well, it didn't. Amy also emptied out her dollhouse. She had all these little wooden dolls and bits of furniture. She emptied it all out, and she replaced it all with dirt, moss, sticks, and leaves. And then, to the absolute horror of her governess, she filled the whole doll's house with beetles, worms, earwigs, and all sorts of random bugs. That was far more interesting to Amy. Well, this was a household that was immersed in God's word, and their father would often read the scripture, and this sort of formed the backdrop to a lot of her life. They would also have family worship, and Sunday was always reserved for the Lord. Amy was taught by her mother about prayer, and she was very young, and this is a very, very famous account of her, but she was probably under 5 years old at this time. And her mother had been teaching her that you can come to God in prayer for anything. There was one thing that troubled the young Amy. It was the color of her eyes. You see, her mother had blue eyes. So many other people around her had blue eyes, but somehow she had brown eyes, and she hated her brown eyes. And so she came to the Lord in prayer, and very fervently did she pray that the Lord would change the color of her eyes from brown to blue. Well, she truly believed that the Lord would do this. And in the morning, she climbed up on the dresser and stared into the mirror, only to be greeted by her own brown eyes. At first, she was really unhappy about this. Hadn't her mother told her that the Lord would hear and answer her prayer, that she could ask for anything? She realized, and perhaps her mother helped her realize, that God had heard her prayer, and he had answered her, and he had said no. As was usual in these Victorian times, Amy was sent to a boarding school very far from home. She was actually sent to Northern England in Harrogate. This was a Christian school, a Wesleyan school, and it was here that she was truly converted in 1883. They had this special meeting, and there they sang this really modern song for the time. It was called "Jesus Loves Me, This I Know." And hearing the words of this song, Amy realized that she had grown up with, you know, hearing a lot about Jesus, about his death, his resurrection, all these types of things. And she knew about Jesus' love, but she'd actually never thought about it for herself. She'd never thought that she had to actually do anything about all of this knowledge that she had grown up with. And it was during this song that she prayed, and she asked the Lord to be her personal Lord and Savior. And at this time, she was 15. Now, unbeknownst to Amy, the milling business that her father owned was going downhill. And the family had to move from the beautiful coastal town of Mill Isle to the industrial town of Belfast. And then, in 1885, tragedy struck the family again. This time it was more severe. Amy's father died suddenly, and this really changed everything. Amy and her two brothers had to be withdrawn from school as they simply couldn't afford the fees. And Amy had to throw herself into helping the family. She helped to educate the four younger siblings. Her mother had extraordinary faith and was a real pillar of strength at this time. And despite the fact that they were in debt and there was so much uncertainty about their future. One Sunday, when Amy was on her way back from church, she saw an old beggar woman. This woman was probably homeless, struggling. She was struggling under a load of all her possessions. She was filthy. She probably smelt unwashed and of alcohol. And she was clearly not a churchgoer. Well, Amy made a decision to walk with this woman, and not only that, but to carry the load that she was carrying. And her two brothers followed her. And they shouldered the load that this woman had, and they walked with her. And people were stopping and staring and looking at her. And these were the very people that she was just sat in church with. They were sort of giving her disapproving glances. It wasn't the done thing, you know, for a woman of her middle-class status, you know, to be walking with this woman. And what was she doing? What would her mother think? And Amy felt the embarrassment rise. And she could almost hear their thoughts. But as she continued to walk, she heard a voice, like almost audibly in her mind, saying a verse of scripture. It was from 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble. Every man's work shall be made manifest, for the day will declare it. And suddenly she understood that. She understood that it really didn't matter what other people thought. She didn't need the approval of other people. It was only the eternal that mattered. This was a bit of a turning point for Amy, and it was a stirring of a new compassion. Now, Belfast was, as I said, an industrial town, and there were many children, young girls particularly, who worked in the mill factories. They were nicknamed the Shawleys because they were too poor to afford hats, so outside they would just put their shawl over their head. Now, these girls often worked all day in these factories. 14-hour days was a normal thing, and they were literally trying to help the family put food on the table. Amy's heart went out to them. She started visiting in the slums and meeting a lot of these girls. And she started to fetch them and create little classes for them. A lot of these girls were completely uneducated, having not been able to afford school. And so she ended up having Bible classes and little groups of gatherings. And this was really Amy's introduction to how the other half lived. She had been fairly well off in her time, and now she was really seeing how the poorest of the poor lived. These years were really packed full of spiritual growth for Amy. She was now 19 years old. And there was this conference that occurred at this time, a very famous annual conference called the Keswick Convention. They used to have a lot of different speakers come and missionaries from across the globe. And this conference was really aimed at trying to challenge and edify and build up the believers. And it was here that she heard, in one of these conferences, she actually heard Hudson Taylor speak. And he spoke about the work in China with the China Inland Mission and about the millions a month that were dying without having heard the name of Jesus. At that time, she was really struggling with the idea of living a consistent and a holy life. She was doing a lot of things, but she herself was feeling really depressed, really low and down. How was she to get the victory over sin? Even though she was doing all these things and working amongst all these girls, running all these different classes, she didn't feel like it was enough. There was always more. Well, the actual messages from this convention she didn't really remember. But what she did remember was the closing prayer. Someone just quoted the words at the end of Jude. Now to him who can keep us from falling. And suddenly she realized that it was God. God had the responsibility to keep her from falling. It was his work in her, and her job was to live in reliance on him. And so she continued her work, but now with renewed vigor. Now, the number of Shawleys, or these girls coming to her classes, was increasing every day. Friends would tell other friends and bring along other friends. And soon these girls were starting to go to the local church. And this was causing quite some upset. You know, all of these lower class kids from the slum packing into the church. A lot of the middle class people were quite unsettled by this. And Amy also realized that they really needed more space. She couldn't run these classes, and she wanted more girls to come, but there simply wasn't the space. She wanted a bigger hall. But how on earth would she get that? Well, she figured that if it was God's work for her, then he would supply. And so she prayed for some sort of building that she would be able to buy with the no money that she had, and somehow that God would provide all of this. Well, she got to work straight away. She found that there was a way of purchasing a kind of like a do-it-yourself warehouse. Not that she would do it, but you could buy land and then you could just buy this warehouse that they would put up. It was literally sheets of metal, and they would sort of erect this building really quickly. And she worked out how much was needed, and she committed it to the Lord. And sure enough, over time, she received the exact funds, not only to buy a little plot of land, which someone sold to her very cheaply, but also to purchase these bits of metal that she could assemble into a huge hall. She called this hall the Welcome, and it's still there today, well, at least a less tin-like building, at least, is there today. Now, she hung a banner across as an invitation. It said, come one, come all to the Welcome Hall and come in your working clothes. This was like a branch of the YWCA. Two students of D.L. Moody came and spoke at the opening of this building, and they sang a brand new hymn. It was the very first time it was sung in the British Isles. It was the hymn, I Know Whom I Have Believed. Now, as her work continued in Belfast, a news spread of what she was doing amongst the mill girls, and she really was making a difference. That building that she had created, that Welcome Hall, could fit 500 people, and she had classes there during the week. She was a lot of people came to help her as well, and she was doing wonders for the people in Belfast. A family friend asked her to come over to Manchester. Manchester was another industrial town in England, and they had a lot of factory workers there. Her mother was also provided some work, and so they thought that the move would be a good one. When Amy went to Manchester, she chose to live in the slums where these girls lived. She felt it would be right. She was going to be right there amongst them. And she had to learn to live without any privacy, without any quiet, two things that she really valued. It was also a very unsafe neighbourhood, and she had to learn to be bold and unafraid in this place that she was living. Little did she know that this was really good training for what lay ahead. One of the key founding people of the Keswick Convention was a man by the name of Robert Wilson. He was a good friend of the Carmichaels, and often the children would go to his great estate in the Lake Districts, and they used to nickname him the DOM, or the Dear Old Man. He was from a Quaker background, but he worked with the Baptists and he worshipped in an Anglican church. Denominations meant nothing to him. He was a very, very wealthy man. He owned some coal mines and things, but he was also extremely lonely. He lived on his vast estate called Broughton Grange, pretty much on his own, but he had two adult sons who were also there on the estate. His wife had died, and also his youngest daughter had died. And this was a huge grief and loss to Robert Wilson. Now, around this time, he had a very strange request for Amy's mother. Amy was now in her early 20s, but still he asked if he could adopt Amy as his own daughter. She was actually the same age that his daughter was when she died. And he really valued Amy's company and the life and vigour that she brought into his life. And he also knew that he could provide for her, and through her, the rest of the family. Well, Amy's mother agreed, and so Amy was formally adopted by Robert Wilson to be his daughter. So in 1890, she moved to Broughton Grange, and he taught her a lot. He taught her many spiritual lessons, and he introduced her to many books, and she brought life and comfort to his lonely existence. Now, Wilson's adult sons, who were in their 30s, they didn't like this arrangement at first. They thought it was strange. And they also didn't like the fact that Amy was running meetings and bringing various girls and having children at their estate. But soon they too came to accept her, and they saw the value that she brought in the sense that she really did truly care for their father. On a snowy evening in 1892, in the quiet of her bedroom, Amy heard God's voice. And she knew it was God's voice. She couldn't really explain how she knew, but she really felt that it was God speaking to her. And there were just two words. And these two words were, "Go ye." Quoting from Matthew chapter 28, "Go ye." Now, since the most recent Keswick Convention that she had attended, she had been really moved by the thought of the thousands, if not millions, of people dying every day without having ever heard of the name of Jesus. And she'd not been able to forget what Hudson Taylor had shared those years ago when he'd talked about China and the millions there that were dying without hearing the word of God or even knowing who Jesus was. And Amy had asked the Lord, you know, what to do with this grief. She had never, ever thought that she would actually be one to go. She thought that maybe the Lord would help her manage this kind of unrest that she was feeling in hearing all of these things. But now the call was unmistakable. She was to go. And she shrank from this. She could only think of all the reasons why she really shouldn't go. Firstly, her mother was a widow, and already, you know, their financial situation was precarious. What about her younger siblings? And then the fact that now she was adopted by Robert Wilson, and wasn't she meant to be there caring for him? Wasn't that all arranged? Anyway, her health was terrible. And anyway, what would she do about money? She had nothing to support herself. Well, the biggest thing for her was leaving her mother. And she wrote out her heart to her mum and talked about how she felt and how all the reasons why she couldn't go. And even in writing the letter, she felt that she was stabbing the people she loved. Her mum wrote back almost immediately. And this is what her mum said. "My own precious child, he has lent me to you all these years. He only knows what a strength, comfort, and joy you have been to me. And so, darling, when he asks you to go now, beyond my reach, can I say nay? No. He is yours, and you are his. I can trust you to him. And my heart unfailingly says, go ye." Robert Wilson, too, was heartbroken at the idea of losing Amy. He had just had her there in his home for a few years now. But also, he sensed God's leading in this, and so he wanted to do everything to support her to go. And it turned out that it was actually Wilson's sons that were the most shocked and protested on their father's behalf that Amy should do such a thing. They felt it was heartless. Hadn't she come to help him? Hadn't she been a help already? Why was she now leaving for good? In fact, many people said things like, "Robert Wilson will be dead before Amy goes through the Mediterranean." Even Amy's aunts thought that she was just enchanted by some strange notion of travelling to foreign lands and that this should be stamped out completely. Amy felt torn by all these opinions. You know, these were people she loved, people she respected. And she learned in this to be dead to self. She had to be dead to all these voices that were blocking that clear call from God. Well, she knew she had to go, but to where? that had not been made clear to her, and she had heard nothing from the Lord about where she would go. But actually, she didn't worry too much about this. The island of Ceylon came to mind, which is modern-day Sri Lanka. But that was soon replaced when she met a Mrs. Stewart, who worked in China with the China Inland Mission. And she heard about her story and thought that maybe this was God's leading. And she remembered that she'd heard from Hudson Taylor about, you know, the millions in China, and she really felt that China now would be the place to go. In 1892, a fund was set up by the Keswick Convention just to send one missionary. Someone had donated a significant amount of money to send one missionary. And that one missionary was going to be Amy Carmichael. So everything was ready. The way was prepared. Her trunk was packed. She had all the advice from various people who had been to China. And so she traveled to London with Robert Wilson, ready to go. And then the news came that the doctors would not clear her. Her health was too frail, and she would not be accepted by the China Inland Mission. Well, Amy was undeterred. She knew clearly that God had called her. But now where was she to go? What was she to do? If the mission board wouldn't have her, she wouldn't be able to go anywhere. And then Amy thought about Japan. Now, she didn't know anyone there, but Mr. Wilson did. He knew a missionary called Barclay Buxton who had been in Japan and had been travelling there. And so he wrote to Barclay Buxton, but he also had the sense that this was the right thing to do. And Amy was so sure that she was to go to Japan that before they even got a reply from this missionary, they booked a passage with some other missionaries to Shanghai and then another passage from Shanghai over to Japan. Well, Amy struggled with the parting. She loved Mr. Wilson as her father, and she knew that she would be leaving him heartbroken. She also knew that although her mother had faithfully given her over to serve the Lord, she also knew that her mother would really miss her and would be very grieved to leave her, to have her leave. When she was on the ship, she wrote that her human life was broken, that she felt she really was leaving everything behind. But she also wrote, "He is enough." Now, Japan was a huge culture shock for the 26-year-old Amy. This was a much more traditional Japan than we really imagine today. It was the old Japan, where people walked around in kimonos and bathed in big wooden tubs that were outside their wooden houses, much to Amy's horror. She learnt so much from the missionary Barclay Buxton, and he had now received that letter of introduction from Robert Wilson and was willing to receive her. She worked alongside him with the various missionaries there that were already in Japan. And because there were many missionaries there, she was able to start work straight away. There were interpreters and people who could speak both English and Japanese. Now, on one occasion, she was speaking to a woman in a village in Japan, and this woman was listening really intently to what Amy was saying, and she was really interested. And Amy felt that her heart was ready to receive the Lord. And so she kept talking to this woman. But suddenly the woman's eyes dropped and she noticed Amy's gloves. Amy was just wearing typical English fur gloves, but you didn't get those in Japan. And so the lady started looking at her gloves and feeling them and then asking about them and wanting to try them on. And the moment was lost. The woman only thought about her gloves. And from that point, Amy thought to herself that she must always dress in the native dress, that she couldn't risk any more distraction from heavenly things for the mere sake of an item of clothing. Now, Japan really was a difficult period for her. She struggled to learn the language, and she struggled with a very, very different culture as well. She also felt intensely lonely. She was speaking with another missionary one day as they walked along, and she made some comment, and this missionary replied almost laughingly and said, "What, you don't mean to say that you think all missionaries love each other?" Amy was really shocked at this. And in the conversation that followed, she realized there was a lot of tension, a lot of friction between the missionaries themselves. Of course, she wasn't naive of the fact that there could be these relationship difficulties. But wasn't love the very testimony to the world? She was determined that this would be her focus, that she prayed to the Lord and asked that he would teach her to learn to love. And that became her focus for the rest of her life, to love one another and to fulfill the Lord's command. Now, Amy's health really was terrible. She had a condition called neuralgia, and this caused a lot of nerve pain, migraines, a lot of fatigue. And for a traditional Irish woman, the food of Japan in the late 1890s was no help whatsoever and made things difficult. Her motto was, "Where he takes me, I will follow. What he feeds me, I will swallow." But the food was not doing her much good. She described the food for her family back home. "There's this brown soup with sea slugs, pickles, a very elderly chicken cooked in sweet sauce, fish that actually hasn't been cooked at all, all served with rice." Her health actually improved when she was able to get her hands on some bread and butter, and she ate that with English tea, and her health improved remarkably. But soon, on the doctor's orders, after episodes of quite serious illness, including things like delirium from fevers and fainting and such like, she was told she had to leave Japan, and she had to get some rest in a completely different climate. So, after 15 months in Japan, the question again, "Where to, Lord?" She was actually feeling very ashamed to leave. She had come close to the people that she worked with, and she'd grown to love them, they'd grown to love her. She'd done work in all these villages, she'd worked so hard to learn the language, and now, well, they would see her as a deserter. But it was all in God's hands. Again, the thought of Sri Lanka or Ceylon came to mind. And so she booked the next passage and she went to Ceylon. But she'd hardly been there when news came that Robert Wilson had had a stroke, and she immediately booked another passage from Ceylon all the way back to England. Well, the travel from Sri Lanka to England was awful. And her health was terrible at that time. I mean, she had to come away from Japan to try and recover. And what she had to do was she took a ship all the way to Europe, to Italy, and then from Italy she took trains all across the country into France, and then France another train to get to the Channel, and then another ship that crossed the Channel to get to London, where she finally met her mother. She felt that it was angels that had helped her through this travelling. There have been times when she'd just been woken up just in time in order to change a train. Or there was a time when she couldn't even carry the luggage, she was so weak and delirious, but then somebody helped her at that very moment. And when she arrived in London, she was so ill that she was in some delirious fever and she couldn't remember that the first few days in England. But finally, by Christmas, she was back in Broughton Grange with the DOM, or Robert Wilson, who was overjoyed to see her, although he was much weakened by the stroke that he had. But Robert Wilson knew that although he had his Amy back again, that this would be temporary. He knew that God had called Amy, and so he knew that there would be another heart-wrenching parting to come. During the stay in England, Amy had spoken to a lot of people. And in that time, she'd heard about southern India. The climate here was quite different, very much different to Japan and China, and far better than Ceylon. The doctors who attended her in London told her pretty much that her health was really bad, and she probably wouldn't manage anything in the tropics. The heat would bring on the neuralgia and the migraines and such like. So the thought of southern India, well, it seemed feasible. And so, after a year in England, she set sail yet again to Madras, or what is known as Chennai today, in South India. She arrived there on November the 9th in 1895. and she would never return to England again. Now, India at this time was under British rule. And unlike in Japan, Christianity had taken root, particularly around the south of India. And this was because there was a lot of people who believed that Thomas, the disciple of Jesus, had actually travelled to India and had been martyred there. And so there were a good deal of Christian sort of clusters around. And of course, with the British rule, it meant that there was also a lot of nominalism. And because there was trade and wealth involved, there was also a fair bit of corruption and other things that had crept in the recent years. But really, when you headed into the villages, Hinduism was the dominant religious force. Now, upon her arrival, Amy began in earnest to learn another language, and this one was hard. Tamil, the South Indian language. It was difficult. If she thought Japanese was difficult, this was even harder. And she threw herself into the study, and she intensely tried to read the grammar books, trying to learn the language. And after so much study, she still couldn't understand anything, and nobody could understand her. But she was encouraged when she remembered that the Lord had enabled a donkey to speak, and therefore, perhaps, there was some hope for her too. She was also learning about the culture of India. She actually found it utterly infuriating. People had a completely different sense of punctuality. She was of good British stock, and the idea of coming on time was very important. And these people simply had no sense of time or punctuality at all. She also had a very no-nonsense attitude to work and loved hard work. And this was quite startling to most of the Indians that she worked with. In fact, most of them thought she was far too busy and always rushing around. And why the rush? They had the attitude of, why do today what you can put off until tomorrow? She also realized very quickly that there was a spiritual battle going on. There were all sorts of demonic festivals, and she did witness demonic demon possessions. There were also these horrible rituals that she learnt about and saw, things like suti, where when a husband died, the wife was also placed on the funeral pyre and burnt alive with him. This was seen as a very noble act. But perhaps the most horrible aspect of the culture that she had to understand was the caste system. This was a strict adherence to a social hierarchy, far stricter than what we would imagine by any kind of class system. When you were born into a high or a low class, you remained in that caste for life. You couldn't marry outside the caste, and you only ever did work that was suitable to your caste. People from a high caste wouldn't even touch a person from a lower caste, or even eat off a plate that they had eaten off, as someone from a low caste had eaten off before. There was a time when she travelled into a village, and she was sat in the home, and the family was gathered around, and she was speaking to them, but in the background, all she could hear was this baby crying and crying. And she ended up going over to the little cot, and she saw this tiny, wasted child sort of grabbing at his eyes. And she looked, and these eyes were swollen and weeping and red. And she knew what it was straight away. She knew it was ophthalmia, this horrible eye disease where the child would have gone blind, and it created this really horrible pain in the eyes. And the child was crying and crying. And she talked to the family, and they said, yes, well, he hasn't slept for months. But at least he's weaker now, so his cries are softer. And Amy said, but can't you take him to the hospital? There's something that can be done for this, and we can give him something for the pain. But the family were horrified at the suggestion. It would break caste, that going to the hospital would mean that they would be associating with other people from another caste, and that could not be done. Amy offered to take the child herself, but again, they refused. What a disgrace to the family. And so the child cried and cried and suffered and suffered. Such was the caste system. In another case, in a village, a baby was dying. It was a newborn baby, and the child was in much need of milk. Finally, they found a woman who had compassion enough to give, to feed this newborn baby and save the child. But in doing so, she broke caste. Her husband later found out and killed her for it. This was the caste system. And it really was the women who suffered the most. And also at this time, there were child marriages, and abuse was very, very common because women had no rights. And suicide rates were really high. Widows were seen as the property of in-laws. And if you were a low caste woman, then you were the lowest of the low. And in a society where men and women were so separate, it was so difficult for the foreign missionaries to reach the women. And often these women suffered terribly behind closed doors. Well, Amy was invited by a missionary who worked in a southern region of India. His name was Thomas Walker. He was a clergyman, and he was part of Church Mission Society, or CMS. Walker was particularly proficient in Tamil, and when he heard of Amy's struggles to learn the language, he offered to teach her. He also thought it would be better for her to be immersed amongst the people, and in that way, she would learn the language well. So, apart from his excellent teaching skills, he also offered her the opportunity to go travelling through these remote villages of southern India. They would travel from village to village, bringing the gospel. Now, Thomas Walker had prayed for more workers to come to join his little band of missionaries, but he never expected a woman. And he realized later that Amy really was the answer to his prayer. She was able to join in, and through her and a little woman's band that sort of formed, they were able to reach the women in these villages and have children's meetings and run little Bible classes and so on. This was quite a difficult life. You know, they would travel on these bullock carts from one village to the next, and they would often have to sleep outside, camping in tents and things, because no village would want foreigners coming in. You know, the Hindus, again, with the caste system, you didn't want to associate with foreigners or have them touch your things. It was also hard, hard work. She sometimes described it as dull, plodding work. And there was a lot of rejection. There was a lot of indifference. Amy would bring medicines and various things that people did want. But there was also a lot of suspicion of Christians. One of an interesting suspicion or rumour that had been spreading was that Christians had this white powder and they sprinkled it through their holy book. And then they would open their holy book and they would speak. And as they spoke, the powder would come into the air and enter the minds of people and change their soul. Well, apart from the white powder, something of the living word of God, perhaps they had understood. Now, often these open-air meetings were very frustrating. Amy would hold these meetings and gather the women and children and so on, and then only after having gathered everybody, they would just be interrupted by an entire herd of cows that sort of passed through their entire meeting and broke up the whole thing again. Sometimes even in a house, they were interrupted by a cow that walked in. So she found it very difficult, sometimes very frustrating. And sometimes she felt, where was the fruit in all of this? But there was fruit. There were two women who chose to follow the Lord around this time. And they did the unthinkable. They broke caste. And they left their families and their whole life behind to join these missionaries. One of these women was called Ponnamal. She had been a widow, and because of child marriages in those days, you could be a widow at the age of 18 or 19. And she was quite young, and she was living with her husband's family, and they treated her like a slave. She had actually thought to kill herself on numerous occasions, and on one particular occasion, she had gone out wanting to throw herself down the well. But something had stopped her, and it was not long after that she met Amy Carmichael and heard the gospel. Her in-laws miraculously agreed to let her go, and Ponnamal never looked back, and she became Amy's firm friend and fellow worker for the rest of her life. In 1901, Amy arrived at a village at night, and early that next morning, a woman came bringing a 7-year-old girl. This girl had told everybody that her name was Prina. She had been standing outside the church at night, and the Christian lady had found her and then knew that the missionaries had just arrived, and so thought she would give her to the missionaries. This tiny girl climbed into Amy's lap, and Amy hugged her and kissed her, and the girl looked up at Amy and said, "Amma," or mother. Soon, Prina's story came to light. And through Prina, Amy suddenly had an insight into the horrors of the Devadasi system. Prina had been sold by her destitute mother to the Hindu temple. She had escaped once before and managed to find her way home by walking over 30 kilometers to her village. Her mother had received her into the back home, but soon enough the temple officials arrived, and Prina, screaming and crying and clutching onto her mother, was wrenched off her mother and taken back to the temple. And her mother allowed this to happen. When Prina was taken back to the temple, her little hands were branded with hot irons. She knew that she was about to be married to the god, and she was terrified. She had seen what had happened to the other girls, and this made her desperate. So again, she decided that she wanted to escape. And so somehow, and how she did it, we don't know, because she was actually being watched carefully after her first escape, she managed to escape on the 6th of March. This time, she knew she wouldn't bother to go back home. And she just ran. She didn't know where she was going. She just ran and ran and ran. And she ended up in a village, exhausted. And she crouched outside a church at night, and just trembling. And there, that Christian woman had found her, all, you know, matted and dirty and her clothes tousled. The Christian woman who saw her there had an idea that this was a temple girl. And she thought she would need to take her back. And that's just what was done in those days. But she also heard that there were some missionaries who just arrived in the village. And that is how Prina ended up in the arms of Amy Carmichael. Prina had remembered her mum hugging her and kissing her on her head, just like Amy had done. And so Amy was Amma now, or mother. Through Prina, Amy started to uncover the horrible secrets of this Hindu tradition. Girls were sold to temples. And this was something families would do in order to get some financial gain. Girls as young as 3 were sold. And you would also get some spiritual bonus points for this. And also, of course, you could get rid of a girl, because girls were a financial drain on poor families. But essentially, this is what we would call sex trafficking today. These young girls were imprisoned in the temples, unable to leave for the rest of their lives. They were dressed up and decorated with garlands of flowers, taught to dance and sing in worship of the various idols and gods. And then they were used as prostitutes by priests and any of the men who came to the temple to worship. It was unspeakably cruel. The children were very badly treated. Prina had scars, she had the burns all over her body, and she often had woke up with fits of nightmares and things like that. It was so depraved that many foreign missionaries thought the people were exaggerating. They didn't believe that it was happening and thought it was just some story that sort of just to scare people. When Amy found out the truth about this, she was horrified, and she asked the Lord, what was she to do now that she knew? Amy at this time was still part of the Walker's itinerant band, which was traveling from village to village, camping out for sometimes 6 weeks at a time. But now, with little Prina in tow, things became a lot more difficult. And soon, 4 more children were just brought to Amy. And these were very young children, and this work that she was doing, traveling from village to village, how could this continue with all these little children? Now, Thomas Walker had recently been asked to help in a different region. And so the whole family moved to a place called Donavore, still in South India, right at the tip, the bottom of India there. This was a more rural, remote area. And there was plenty of space, and there was this abandoned mission house which they could use for their growing family. Now, Amy wrote back home to England about the changes and the new directions that have been taking place. And she talked very honestly about the need for prayer. She talked about the difficulties, all the problems, the fact that they could speak and nobody would listen, the fact that there was this indifference. And she really wanted people to know that the life of a missionary was hardly glamorous at all. Well, this turned into a publication called Things As They Are. But when the editors read the manuscript that Amy had written, they sent it back immediately and said, would she be able to adjust her manuscript slightly just to make it a little more encouraging, a little less bleak? Well, Amy refused to do that, so she put it in her top drawer and forgot about it. But later, some British missionaries came and joined her and saw what India was like and saw the work. And they heard that she'd written this book. And so they took it and they said, this needs to be published. People need to know what it's like here. And they added their own photos to this particular book and this publication. And then finally it was published in Britain. And it's the book called Things As They Are. Now, Amy never imagined that she would marry or have a family of her own. She felt that God had called her to a single life. She felt she'd be more useful. And she felt that that was a very clear thing for her. She had this idea that she wanted this beautifully simple life. A simple life where you could just put all your possessions in one little bundle and that was it. And you could live on the road with no strings attached. Well, she loved this idea. So she really didn't expect the fact that the very work that God called her to was to be a mother to all these children. More little girls were being brought to the missionaries, and it was clear that Amy simply couldn't continue this itinerant work. She tried, but she really couldn't do it. Now, not all of these girls were from the temple. In fact, those girls were very, very hard to reach. These were children who had diseases or disabilities or who were too ugly to be sold to the temple or simply unwanted. But Amy really had a heart for the temple girls, those girls imprisoned behind those four walls. But she didn't understand how she would be able to find these girls before they became temple property. Well, here, Ponnamal, her dear friend, was really helpful. And so the two of them would go into all these different places that foreigners never went into. And Amy would stain her skin, her face, her hands, and she would wear a sari, of course. And with her brown eyes, she could really pass for an Indian, particularly in the twilight. And so she found her way into these Hindu festivals, even into temples themselves, and learned and understood about this Devadasi system and worked out ways of rescuing these girls. Now, Donavore became Amy's home. She left the travelling work to Thomas Walker and his wife. And she knew now that her work was here, to look after these girls in this house. And she really felt that the Tamil proverb of children tie the feet was definitely true in her case. Thomas Walker supported her in this work, and he really helped with a lot of the legal matters that arose. Even after children were given over to the missionaries, later relatives could just turn up and demand the child come back. Sometimes there was one particular case where a girl was kidnapped by relatives, and by the time Thomas Walker had tracked down where she was, she had been drugged and married off to someone. Girls as young as 10 and 11 could be married off. And many of these cases were motivated by property or, you know, inheritance or some other thing that meant that money was tied up in these relations. And this was an endless emotional toil on the family, but particularly on Amy and Walker. Soon the work here at Donavore became really significant. By 1904, there were 30 children. The youngest was an unwanted baby from a temple baby. Who came 13 days old. There were a little group of Indian Christian women who would help to care for the children, but really the labourers were very few. Amy's mother, Catherine Carmichael, came to help for a year, and she wrote, "Since we came here a month ago, I can truthfully say that Amy has scarcely had leisure even to eat. She is mother, doctor, and nurse day and night. In less than 10 years, this family had expanded to 130 children, girls. And soon there were nurseries for all the babies. There was, you know, these mud brick buildings for the older ones and these huge kitchens with cooking rice for all these hungry little mouths. Amy was definitely in charge, but there were so many tiny little menial tasks that need to be done. And so much so that even walking from building to building wasted too much time for her. So she got a little tricycle and she would ride her little bike between all the buildings. And she would have been quite a sight, this little Irish woman on this bike zooming along from building to building with a whole lot of children running after her. Ponnamal was central to the work, and she had an excellent mind for detail, for calculations, for remembering medicine, for negotiating rice prices with the locals. But she also had such a skill with the babies and the very sick children and those who were really difficult were often given to Ponnamal. And doctors marveled at Ponnamal's skill with children and her knowledge. And she told them that she simply asked God. She would pray over a sick child, and there were times when God told her, you know, to mix a certain something into the medicine or to make the food of a certain consistency. And she would hear the Lord's voice in this, follow him, and he helped her in her work. There were many times when Amy reflected that it was angels that were caring for this little Donovan family. There was an occasion when cholera broke out in all the surrounding villages, but not one baby became sick in Donovan. There were other times when there was one particular time when Amy felt really led to go into the nursery to check on the babies. This was in the middle of the night. So she got up and she walked to the nursery and everything was calm and quiet. And so she started to walk away, but something in her told her, get inside, go inside. And so she walked in and she saw amongst the 12 babies, one baby who'd been playing with the ropes of the hammock, and the rope was around the child's neck, and the child was suffocating to such an extent that the child couldn't make any sound. And Amy was just in time to cut the rope and save that little life. Amy always wanted that little compound in Donovan to be a home for these girls. These girls had no home, so this would be their home. She wanted to know each of them, and for a time there, when it was actually feasible, she would kiss each one of them goodnight. She was involved in their spiritual and academic education, and she gave them all sorts of experiences, taught them to swim in a lake, taught them all about nature, birds, trees, flowers, all the bugs. Many girls didn't even know their own birthday. Some girls came without a name. And Amy made sure that their arrival date was always recorded. It became their coming day, as she would say. And on their coming day, they would have a celebration. She would prepare a gift. They would have a breakfast with Amy. She also remembered the days of the long, dreary meetings she had to sit through as a kid. And she was remembering sitting in the pews of a church building in Ireland and thinking, when is this going to end? So she made sure that her meetings were really short and that every kid would be involved. She gave the youngest one these coloured flags that they could wave every time a song was sung. And she even gave the older ones percussion instruments, sticks with brass pots and all sorts. So you can imagine that their meetings were very loud and lively and very colourful. Amy had also been brought up with a lot of discipline and order. And so there was all of that in the Donovan family too. One young girl remembered, actually as a woman, she remembered back, she reflected back on when she was a girl growing up in Donovan. She was particularly rebellious and she was always in trouble. And again, she had done something which meant, of course, that she had to be disciplined, and she was disciplined through a whole lot of people, but she still didn't change, and finally she was sent to Amy. And she knew what this meant. She knew that she would get the stick. And so she walked into Amy's room and she reluctantly held out her hands and she watched as Amy took the stick off the shelf. And then Amy struck her own hands, repeatedly struck her own hands. And this girl just watched as Amy hit herself. Well, Amy taught her in that moment grace. Now, the girl didn't change immediately, but that memory stayed with her for a long time, and later she came to the Lord. And so Amy's days in India were spent cutting thousands of fingernails and baby toenails, washing nappies, rocking sick children to sleep, teaching songs and scriptures to verses, disciplining the little rebels. It was such a vastly different life to anything she imagined when she'd heard those words from God, "Go ye." But she remembered, and she wrote, "It is not a servant's business to decide which work is great and which is small, which is unimportant or which is important. A servant is not greater than his master." And the work at the Donavore compound was truly exhausting. And there were times when Amy collapsed with fevers and exhaustion. Her neuralgia that had plagued her whole life had never gone away, even though she'd asked the Lord to take it away. But she lived what she taught. You can give without loving, but you cannot love without giving. And Amy really did love all those children that God had given her and her fellow workers. And she gave herself completely to this work. Now, how was it all funded? Well, Amy learnt from her experiences at Belfast and in Manchester that God provides for his work. And she prayed specifically for needs, and faithful believers all over the world partnered with Amy in this work, sometimes sending huge reams of material or a whole box of nappy pins. Sometimes they send a certain amount of money. There was a time when she built the house of prayer, like a meeting hall. And she'd finished the building, and then they'd had no money whatsoever left over. She'd had the exact amount. But soon, she found that bats were finding their way into the building, nesting on the rafters. And then there were all these sparrows in the building, and they were tweeting so loudly that they would drown out any speaker that tried to speak. And so she knew that they needed some sort of screens to block out all this wildlife. But they had no money for it whatsoever. Well, the next day, a mail order arrived, and somebody from America had sent $100 and a note to say that they'd felt prompted to send this money to finish a work. And when converted, it was the exact amount they needed, 270 rupees. God again had provided, and that's how Amy lived. Now, the years before the 1920s were full of grief and loss for Amy. The DOM had passed away in 1905, and Amy really grieved him like a father. And in 1912, Thomas Walker went on another trip to visit another village, as he usually did, but he contracted cholera, and he died within a few days. He was just 54, and at that time, his wife had just left she was in England, for her health. Her health was really bad as well. So it was a real tragedy to the family. And then in 1913, Amy received a letter that Catherine Carmichael, her mother, had died. And then again in 1915, Ponnamal, her dear, dear friend and right-hand woman, who was so crucial in the work, died after a battle with cancer. And Amy felt so utterly alone. How was she going to continue with these pillars, these people who had been such a support for her, all of them gone? In fact, many people felt that without Thomas Walker, you know, Amy was vulnerable, and they thought things would just ground to a halt and it would all come to nothing. But Amy still held on to the sense that this was God's work. She wrote a poem at this time, after Ponnamal's death, and her final line of this poem is, "In acceptance lieth peace." After many years, the compound grew to include a hospital. And on top of that, Amy had also discovered that this Devadasi system was not exclusively for girls, although that was mainly what it was. She found out that even some young boys were bought by the temple and were temple property and used as prostitutes as well. And this led to her work increasing and to include young boys as well as part of the work. And of course, this meant a change in things. They needed more men to be part of the work, to educate the boys, to care for them. And it was very hard to find men who were willing to work in this environment, and particularly under her leadership. But again, she prayed, and she knew that the Lord would provide. And he did. Two brothers, Murray Webb Peplow and his brother Godfrey, asked to join the work after they had to leave China after some political unrest. And Murray was also a doctor. By this time, people from all over the world were coming to help in this work. People from Germany, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and of course, Britain. They came to see for themselves what was happening. And because Amy's books, she had written a couple of books and Things As They Are, one in particular, had been read and spread across many continents now, many came out of curiosity. Many had heard these rumours about this strange woman, this Irish woman in the tip of India. But there were so many others who saw that there was a need and they wanted to offer their help. Amy used to tell the new recruits that mission work was not glamour. It was dull plodding, and essentially, it was a chance to die. That's a good ad, isn't it? Some who came were quite critical of her, critical of the work, feeling that maybe it was too insular, that the education wasn't adequate for the girls and the boys, they needed to see more of the world and so on. But others were really changed in meeting Amy personally and witnessing as well the love and the harmony between all the workers. And Amy ultimately never really minded what people said about her. She committed both the criticism and the praise to God. And there were discouragements. There were many conversions and baptisms through the years. But some of them were not real. Some of them were not genuine. And some of them were professed conversions which were very shallow and didn't stand any test of time. There were a lot of children who were rebellious. Some who, no matter what you did, no matter the love you gave them, continued to rebel and grieve the heart of the people. But Amy used to write, she said, "Better to be disappointed 1,000 times, yes, and deceived, than to miss a chance to help us all. The love of God suffices for any disappointment and for any defeat." And she would often quote the words that Thomas Walker used to tell her. "Success is not required of us. Faithfulness is." On October the 24th in 1931, Amy, now in her 60s, prayed to God. She wrote, "Do with me as you want. Do anything that will fit me for serving, to serve you and to help my beloveds." That evening, she was surveying a building in another town. It was a medical facility and she had the plans, and only a scaffold was made. It was all just mud and sort of scaffolding. She walked inside the building. It was now twilight, so fairly dark. And she slipped. And she fell into a pit that was being dug to be a toilet. The builders had put it in a completely different spot to the plan. In the fall, she dislocated her ankle, twisted her spine and broke her leg. And she was in her 60s. Well, she was hopeful that she would recover. But she actually never did. 3 decades now had passed, and this time in India had really taken its toll. The neuralgia that she had arthritis, she had a whole lot of other medical complaints. And now she could hardly sleep without medication, and her body really didn't heal. Well, the Lord had heard her prayer and had fit her for service, and she was bedridden. Now, one would think that this would lead to retirement or something, or she would leave. But Amy had no such plan for herself. She could no longer go out of her room. And she was, so essentially, she got everyone to come to her. She was constantly meeting people, new workers, visitors, children, the ones who needed to be disciplined, ones who came to borrow books. And she wrote a daily message for her family, often focusing on love and unity, a theme that had never left her life since she had had that conversation in Japan. She herself wanted to know Calvary love in every moment of every day. And really, the unity that did exist amongst the workers was a huge testimony, especially in India, with that caste system, to see people who were previously from a high caste changing and washing nappies, working with people from the lowest caste in harmony. This was a huge testimony to other people who came and knew the society of India. To a woman who the indoors was a horror to, Amy had a lot to get used to and a lot to endure. But she always said, you must never ask God why. To will what God wills brings peace. And actually, this period of her life was very, very fruitful. Had she been just, you know, doing her normal thing and carrying on with life, she would never have written the thousands of letters that she wrote. She was an extremely fast writer. She wrote to other missionaries, to people all around the world. She wrote poetry. She wrote 13 books, which ended up being published, and little notes of encouragement to staff members, as well as the daily family message. Much of these have been collated and turned into devotionals. Little did she know that God truly had answered that prayer of October the 24th. And had fit her for service for people all over the world and for years to come. Well, in 1948, she had another fall, and this fall ended all her movement, and she was unable to get out of bed. She also was unable to move her hand, so she couldn't write. Now, that didn't stop her. She just started to dictate her letters. And beyond her walls, the Donovan Fellowship, as it was now called, it continued. It continued on. There were now 900 people in this compound. There was a hospital with three doctors servicing the local community. There were teachers educating the girls over here, the boys over there. And there were people pounding all the tons of rice that was needed to feed everybody, changing nappies, taking all the toddlers out to play in the gardens. Over 1,000 children had come through this compound. And many of those children who'd been rescued were workers there now and were actually caring for the other children. But Amy had a sense that her time on earth was coming to an end, and she couldn't wait. She was now in her 80s. She told one of a nurse who was going back to England, she said, "When you hear I am gone, jump for joy. I want tambourines and triumph at my funeral." And so, after 20 years of being bedridden, Amy Carmichael's day came in 1951. She had waited for this day with great anticipation. She would finally be free of her aged, twisted body, and she would be with her Savior and Lord. She wanted no memorial stone, no big ceremony. Her grave, she said, was temporary after all. But when she passed away, her children did want to remember her. Her children, her former children, the workers, the other missionaries there. And so they got around this little, her instructions. And instead of marking the grave, they put a bird bath on this place where she was buried. And on the bird bath is just one word, Amai, which means true mother. The place in Donovan today that Amy established is still running, and the legacy continues. It still provides homes for children and also the elderly. And some of the great-grandchildren of the very girls who called Amy Amma are still connected to the work here. And the other legacy is really seen in Amy's writings, which are plentiful. And in her writing, if you read some of her work, you will see in there a heart that is always wanting to strive onwards, to go deeper, to go further, to examine oneself, and to know, to truly know, Calvary love. I'm going to end with a poem. I really like this poem. It's called "Make Me Thy Fuel." From prayer that asks that I may be sheltered from winds that beat on thee, from fearing when I should aspire, from faltering when I should climb higher, from silken self, O captain, free thy soldier who would follow thee. From subtle love of softening things, from easy choices, weakenings, not thus are spirits fortified, not this way went the crucified. From all that dims thy Calvary, O Lamb of God, deliver me. Give me the love that leads the way, the faith that nothing can dismay, the hope no disappointments tire, the passion that will burn like fire. Let me not sink to be a clod, Make me thy fuel, flame of God. And that's the story of Amy Carmichael.